From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Adrienne Rich writes about the passion of politics and the politics of passion. On today's Fresh Air, the poet and feminist rethinks some of her earlier writing on women's culture. Also today, the lighter side of being paralyzed for life. Cartoonist John Callahan is a paraplegic, and some of his funniest work is about the disabled, but the cartoons make some people too uncomfortable to laugh. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of music by composer Virgil Thompson. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg gives you some ammunition against pretentious friends and colleagues who overuse the word shall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. A young woman poet was speaking to a noted male poet at a party. Young women shouldn't write poems, he told her. They are poems. The young woman was a friend of poet Adrienne Rich, and Rich has used that story as an example of what women poets were up against in the 1950s and 60s when she was getting established. Rich went on to become one of the first widely published contemporary feminist poets. Her work held a special place for many women readers who were looking for poems that related to their lives, and to many women poets looking for signs of encouragement. In the 1950s, when she was in her 20s, Rich had several collections of poems published, but in that decade she gave birth to three sons and felt constantly torn between her literary ambitions and family responsibilities. She's addressed that in her poems and in her book Of Woman Born, Motherhood as Experience and Institution. In the introduction to the book, she wrote, "We need to understand the power and powerlessness embodied in motherhood in patriarchal culture." Since becoming a lesbian feminist, Rich has tried to help define alternatives to patriarchal values. Adrienne Rich has a new collection of poems called Time's Power.
I picked the title of this book, which is a phrase from a poem in it, because it seemed to me that the poems were, to some extent, the product of a greater consciousness about time, a consciousness coming not only from growing older, but from the sense of the brevity of so many lives of people I've cared about. Young people cut off in their 20s, 30s, early 40s by AIDS, by cancer, by violence. And that sense of living into one's 60s as almost a privilege in a time like this, the perspectives that that can give you, the time to see your own life and work unfold, to see your see the history of your time unfolding, that seems to me more and more a very precious thing.
I'd like for you to read the first two stanzas from the opening poem in Time's Power, and the poem is called Sofeggietto. Feel free to introduce this in any way if you'd like.
Well, the title Solfeggietto is the title of a once famous piano piece that was studied by many young piano students, including myself, when I was growing up. And the poem is a dialogue, it's a monologue, really, of a daughter to her mother, a daughter who has studied music with her mother, also a musician. I see the poem as an attempt to take further some of the perceptions, some of the perspectives on that much discussed, much analyzed relationship, which I've written about a great deal. Solfeggietto. Your windfall at 15, your Steinway grand, paid for by fire insurance, came to me as birthright, a black cave with teeth of ebony and ivory, twanging and thundering over the head of the crawling child until that child was set on the big book on the chair, to face the keyboard world of black and white, already knowing the world was black and white. The child's hands, smaller than a sand dollar, set on the keys, wired to their mysteries. The child's wits facing the ruled and ruling staves. For years we battled over music lessons, mine taught by you. Nor did I wonder what that keyboard meant to you, the hours of solitude, the practicing, your life of prize recitals, lifted hopes, Piatti's nephew praising you at 16, scholarships to the north, or what it was to teach boarding school girls what won't be used, shelving ambition, beating time to On the Ice at Sweetbriar or The Sunken Cathedral, for a child counting the minutes and the scales to freedom.
In that poem, you have the expression shelving ambition. I believe your mother put her performance career on hold to have a family.
Yes, that's true. My mother was trained as a concert pianist and as a composer, and ceased to work in any sense publicly in either of those fields after she married. However, I guess I'd like to say that this is not simply a poem about my mother mm-hmm. and myself. I'm very much interested in the place of biography in poetry and in fiction, but I'm also interested in the place of fiction in poetry. And I think that there's a tendency at present to read poems as autobiographical statements, documents, narratives, and to miss, therefore, a great deal that's going on in them if you ascribe each event to some actual event, if you ascribe each image, each situation, each relationship to some literal occasion. It seems to me that you run the risk of missing not only the poetry, but the fuller, richer, deeper aspects of the poem, which come not necessarily from the poet's biography, but from what the poet has seen, heard, drawn into herself or himself from other lives.
Mm-hmm. I want to quote a line from Solfeggietto that's in a stanza that we didn't get to, and that is, "The mother cannot teach the daughter because this is not the story of a mother teaching magic to her daughter." I really like that line, and I can explain why. Stories about magical mothers and magical daughters and magical women somehow seem to leave me out. I always feel left out of those because mm-hmm. I don't feel like a very magical person. And it always seems to me that if being a woman entails having a certain amount of magic, then what does that make me? I'm not the magical type. Does that make me less of a woman? Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Yes. Well, I think in writing those lines, I too was thinking about the tendency to mythologize the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, I feel that I myself have participated in that in some of my earlier work. I think that it is perhaps that tendency that we have to try to correct the mythologies that we feel have harmed us, the mythologies that deny the strengths and the powers that women have passed on to women, that mothers have transmitted to daughters. And these are very real, and we know that they are very real. But at the same time, there are other stories. And I feel as though there needs to be a corrective to the corrective, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We tried in the early years of the feminist movement to look under and behind the myths, the legends that always depicted the stepmother, for instance, as cruel, the bad mother. Myths in popular psychology of the evil mother, the evil mother-daughter bond. We tried to correct those, and in so doing, I think we unearthed a great deal that was real and important and useful. At the same time, as you say, to idealize, to sentimentalize, to mythologize that, those powers, those strengths, those teachings, takes us into yet another place where I think we are disempowered.
Well, did you ever feel that in wanting to celebrate women and being a woman, that you risked having that interfere with honesty, because there's so much ambiguity and ambivalence when you really look honestly at just about anything? And I think it's really the job of a poet to be very honest.
I agree with you. But I've never felt, I think that I when I said that I had participated in this mythologizing, I think that I participated in it perhaps in some poems, but mostly in prose, and that essentially poetry, if it is poetry, does not lend itself to simple readings, to oversimplifications, although people may try to read it that way. It seems to me that the essential nature of a poem is that there is ambivalence and ambiguity quivering underneath, and that there is tension, there is contradiction. That is of the very essence of poetry.
Well, I want to have you read some more of your poems and talk with you about them some more, but first we have to take a short break. Poet Adrienne Rich is my guest, and her new collection of poems is called Time's Power. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Adrienne Rich, I'd like for you to read another poem. This poem dates back to 1972. It's called From a Survivor, and it's both a poem, I think, about the difficulty of lasting relationships, and it's also a poem about a suicide.
From a Survivor. The pact that we made was the ordinary pact of men and women in those days. I don't know who we thought we were, that our personalities could resist the failures of the race. Lucky or unlucky, we didn't know the race had failures of that order and that we were going to share them. Like everybody else, we thought of ourselves as special. Your body is as vivid to me as it ever was, even more, since my feeling for it is clearer. I know what it could do and could not do. It is no longer the body of a god or anything with power over my life. Next year it would have been 20 years, and you are wastefully dead, who might have made the leap we talked too late of making, which I live now not as a leap, but a succession of brief, amazing movements, each one making possible the next.
Tell me if this is too personal, but I know your husband committed suicide.
Yeah, I don't really think that that's appropriate.
Okay. I think the 1970s were for you a period of great change. You became a radical feminist, and you also came out. I was wondering if, at that time, You saw lesbianism as both a political as well as a sexual choice.
I'm one of the lesbians who came out through the women's movement. And I don't mean that I wouldn't have come out if there had been no women's movement, but it's very hard to imagine the world without the women's liberation movement at this point. However, in my own history, that was the point. And it was a time of tremendous intensity among women of all kinds, women who had known they were lesbians all their lives, women who were then coming out, women who were then and have remained heterosexual. There was a kind of intensity around the politics that was very profound and passionate. It was very moving and very exciting to see women taking their strength, taking hold of their strength and taking hold of each other's strength and bringing out the power in each other as was happening in that collective movement or movements of women. And the passion was political and the politics was passionate. And I think that would have to be my answer to your question. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was very sexual. And it was also in a milieu and in a time which was very political.
Poet Adrienne Rich is my guest. I want to talk with you a little bit about love poems. You once said that male poets, even men who are politically or aesthetically radical, tend to sentimentalize sexuality in love poems. And I'd like for you to explain that, perhaps offer an example of what you mean. And this is a statement
you made
a while ago.
I don't want to pick out an example this point, but what I was trying to talk about was the appearance of the woman in male poetry as occupying a certain kind of space, asleep on a bed, dead, as muse, as prophetess perhaps, as occupying some kind of rather mystical or else purely sexual zone. Women living the fullness of their lives are not usually found in poetry by men. They are seen in relation to the male poet. And I think that is less true in poetry by women about men. I couldn't prove that, but I think it is less true. I think that there is a good deal more realism about the nature of the relationship between the sexes.
Mm-hmm. No, in one of your earlier poems from your collection, Diving Into the Wreck, you have a poem called Translations. And there's a line in that poem that says, "She's a woman of my time, obsessed with love, our subject. Mm-hmm. We've trained it like ivy to our walls." Yet, I have to say, I don't think you've written many love poems yourself.
Well, not all love poems are obvious as such, shall
uh-huh.
we say.
Uh-huh. Well, you actually
what
have...
What is a love poem anyway?
Well,
I've just been reading the manuscript of an incredible volume coming out in January by the Southern poet Minnie Bruce Pratt called Crime Against Nature. It's a book of poems which have to do with the removal from her custody of her sons by her husband because she is a lesbian. And I have thought about these poems as some of the most passionate love poems I have ever read. They happen to be to her sons
mm-hmm.
and about her sons.
Well, you have a poem called Love Poem in your new collection, Time's Power, and I'd like for you to read it.
Love Poem. Tell me, Bristler, where do you get such hair? So quick a flare, so strong a tongue. Green eyes, fierce curls, there and here a mole, a girl's dimples, a warrior's mind. Dark blood under gold skin, testing the world, the word. And so to write for you a pretty sonnet would be untrue. to your mud river flashing over rocks, your delicate coffee bushes, and more I cannot know, and some I labor with. And I mean to stay true, even in poems, to you. But there's something more. Beauty, when you were young, we both thought we were young. Now that's all done. We're serious now about death. We talk to her daily as to a neighbor. We're learning to be true with her. She has the keys to this house. If she must, she can sleep over.
I like the sense that love and the praise of love isn't necessarily the praise of physical beauty. It's beyond that, and that age changes that. And there's,
well, it's also that a long-lived relationship is about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a dense and complex process, always a process, and it's not to be summed up. It's not to be turned into some kind of vignette. And if we are serious, we also have to recognize that even the longest and richest and densest relationship must end, and that we see it around us, we see it in that inevitability of time's power, if you will. I would say that this poem, as much as this is a very compressed poem, and that it's as much a death poem as it is a love poem.
I want to ask you something. You've made it clear to me before the interview and a little bit during the course of the interview that you aren't that interested in talking autobiographically, that you'd rather keep your discussion to the work itself. And I guess I'd like to know why that's so, for a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of your poems are very personal, and also a lot of your essays have been autobiographical in nature. And also because of the, you know, one of the best-known early beliefs in feminism was that the personal is political.
I am very convinced that the personal is political, and that is why, certainly in my prose writings, I have been very directly autobiographical. On the other hand, it doesn't stop there. The personal doesn't automatically become the political. You have to make it so. You have to understand it so. Women have always, for example, talked with each other personally about their troubles with men, their problems in their marriages, their sorrows and joys in raising their children. These have not necessarily been political discussions. When consciousness raising began in the early days of the women's movement, it was not simply group therapy. It was carried on with a very deliberate political end, which was to extrapolate and generalize from these individual stories to see larger patterns, to see how socially and politically these things could change. In the era of the 70s and 80s, I think we've seen a kind of vulgarization of that. We've seen an increasing fascination in the media with the private scandals of various people, celebrities created out of thin air, politicians, media stars. We've seen a kind of People magazine approach to journalism, even to criticism to some extent. And I feel as if I want to be a voice against the complete personalization of art and politics. We create art out of our struggle with and within a society. We make our politics out of our struggle with and within a society. We have our unique and individual experiences as people doing these things, but it doesn't rest with the individual and unique experience. There is the absolute necessity to make connections and to make connections to the wider system, the wider structure that is constraining us, that is holding us back, that is oppressing us, if you will. And this, I feel, we see far too little. I also feel as if the criticism and reviewing of poetry right now is not what it needs to be, that there is very little understanding of a poem as a particular way of using language, a particular way of using images and physical sensations in language, a particular way of creating music through language, voices, dialogue, fictions, and that the reading of a poem as yes, in that year the poet met this person, did that, went here, went there, and now we can trace this in this poem. And we're going to read everything in the poem with reference to that. Means that you read the poem and miss a lot.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for doing it. My guest has been poet Adrienne Rich. She has a new collection of poems written between 1985 and 1988. It's called Time's Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Arlie Hochschild. Her new book, The Second Shift, reveals the results of a study she did on two career families. She found that when both parents work full-time, typically the wife continues to be the primary parent and remains ultimately responsible for keeping house. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Are John Callahan's cartoons funny, sick, or a bit of both? His gags are often about the disabled, and not all of his readers realize he's a paraplegic himself. Coming up, John Callahan talks about his new memoir, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a musical offering for the 4th of July. It's a new recording of music by American composer Virgil Thompson. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg lets us know when using the word shall is not only pretentious, but also grammatically incorrect. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Doreen McAllister. Government officials in Grenada say a police official went on a shooting rampage at the capital's police headquarters today. The gunman killed a U.S. diplomat and a police chief and wounded two others. In Washington, the State Department says the gunman was killed by the other law officers after the shooting. The State Department official says John Butler, a political officer at the U.S. embassy, was not the target of the attack but was caught in the crossfire. The motive for the attack is not known. China's new Communist Party chief said today that the government will show no mercy to its leaders of the pro-democracy movement. Party General Secretary Jiang Zemin says putting an end to the turmoil must be firmly carried out. China's official news agency reported said the plotters, organizers, and behind-the-scenes commanders of the democracy movement should be severely punished. China's ambassadors are reportedly being recalled to Beijing from across the globe for consultations on mending China's image. Western diplomats say the envoys will be briefed on the official version of the crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators. Japanese Prime Minister Ueno is denying that he's planning to resign, but there is concern among Japanese officials that a controversy surrounding Ueno will render him ineffective at the Paris summit next month. David Powers reports.
Mr. Ueno's denial was prompted by banner headlines in all the main Japanese newspapers and TV reports that he wanted to resign because of continuing allegations about his private life. The Prime Minister has repeatedly refused to comment on allegations that he paid a number of women, including a geisha or traditional entertainer, for sexual favours before he took office a month ago. However, sources close to the Prime Minister's office say Mr. Ueno has privately expressed anxiety about attending the summit without being able to give a satisfactory reply to the allegations in public. Some political analysts are interpreting Mr. Ueno's denial more as a change of mind and say that his ability to lead the government through important local and national elections over the next month has been seriously called into question.
The BBC's David Powers. A 24-hour national train strike was a headache for commuters in Great Britain today, and the railroad union says the headache isn't going to go away. The union says it will repeat the walkout every week until it wins its pay demands. The union has struck for the second time in as many weeks to protest a 7% pay offer from state-owned British Rail. In London, subway workers staged a sympathy strike. About 350 coal miners converged today on the Greenwich, Connecticut-based Pittston Company headquarters to press the nation's second-largest coal exporter to agree to a contract to end a strike which has idled thousands of miners. Scott Harris has details.
Union organizer Richard Trinquisti explains the importance of the Pittston fight to all miners.
It's become very, very apparent to all of our membership that it'd be only a matter of time. If Pittston gets away with what they're trying to do to their employees, we're going to be confronted with all kind of Pittstons down the road. We're drawing the line in the sand with Pittston. We are not going to go back.
The union appealed today to Pittston Chair Paul Douglas to join mine workers president Richard Trumka in accepting West Virginia's Governor Gaston Caperton's offer to host face-to-face talks. Pittston today had no comment on the proposal. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Harris in Greenwich, Connecticut.
United Airlines was forced today to postpone service on some newly delivered aircraft. Pilots for the airline have refused to fly Boeing 747-400 jumbo jets because of an ongoing labor contract dispute. Wall Street stocks fell today amid renewed fears of a recession after the government announced a larger-than-expected fall in the May leading economic indicators. The Dow Industrials fell 21.63 to 2504.74. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In celebration of Independence Day, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of music by an acclaimed American composer of the 20th century, Virgil Thompson, whose life spans the entire century so far.
I was born in Kansas City, Missouri in 1896, writes Virgil Thompson. Grew up there and went to war from there. That was the other war. He studied in Paris with the great modernist teacher Nadia Boulanger. After the German occupation, he returned to New York as music critic for the Herald Tribune. He still lives at the Chelsea Hotel. He's won nearly every major award, both for his music and for his writing about it. But one shouldn't be academic about Thompson. Through the century, his music has retained its youthful, cheeky spirit. It can charm you and touch you simultaneously. His most famous works are the two unconventional operas he wrote to librettos by Gertrude Stein, Four Saints in Three Acts, and his opera about suffragette Susan B. Anthony, the mother of us all. He also wrote the scores to three famous documentaries, The Plow That Broke the Plains, The River, and Robert Flaherty's Louisiana Story. Albany Records has just released an appealing selection of Virgil Thompson, conducted by American conductor James Boley, the superb director of New Hampshire's annual Monadnock Music Festival. Here's part of Thompson's exuberant Symphony on a Hymn tune, completed in 1928, but not performed until 1945, though Thompson used a version of the last movement in 1937 in The River, Per Lorenz's cinematic contemplation of the Mississippi Basin. This album spans the 40-year period between the hymn tune Symphony and Thompson's third opera, Lord Byron, maybe the most incomprehensibly neglected of all American operas. It was commissioned for the Met, but never performed there. The libretto is by poet Jack Larson, who is probably better remembered as the actor who played Jimmy Olsen on the original Superman TV series. British tenor Martin Hill sings both the five tenor solos from Lord Byron, which are actual lines from Byron, and an earlier Thompson cantata using more Byron, Shipwreck and Love Scene from Byron's Don Juan. I wish Hill were a little more ironic and Byronic a Byron, less pale and wan a Don Juan. Here's the first of Byron's solos, Alas, the Love of a Woman. It is known to be a lovely and a fearful thing.
Upon that day is thrown.
Boley conducts the Budapest Symphony Orchestra in the Byron Selections and in two beautiful orchestral companion pieces, A Solemn Music, which Thompson wrote in memory of Gertrude Stein and the artist Christian Berhard, and A Joyful Fugue. But in Thompson's two symphonies, Boley's own Monadnock Festival Orchestra is the more impressive ensemble. Let's end with a selection from the Symphony No. 2, one of Thompson's most brilliant works in his international style. Thompson composed it in 1930, but completely reorchestrated it 10 years later. Its first performance was with the Seattle Symphony Orchestra under Sir Thomas Beecham on November 14, 1941. Thompson writes of the military suggestions of horn and trumpet. 3 weeks later, it would be hard for an American to exude such cheerful C major confidence.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the CD Virgil Thompson on Albany Records, a new independent label based in Albany, New York. This is Fresh Air. John Callahan's autobiography begins like this. On the last day I walked, I woke up without a hangover. I was still loaded from the previous night. Callahan continued drinking throughout that day. His equally inebriated friend was driving him home from a bar when he smashed into a utility pole at 90 miles an hour. Callahan was left paralyzed from the chest down. That was in 1972. Today, Callahan is a recovering alcoholic and a cartoonist. His grip is very weak, and that gives his drawings a childlike quality. What he finds funny, some people find offensive, cartoons about the disabled. His cartoons have been published in Penthouse and the National Lampoon. I asked him to describe a few.
Okay. I have this cartoon with two cut-off heads on the street corner, just disembodied heads with on little carts with tin cups, and one of them is blind. And the sighted cut-off head is saying to the blinded cut-off head, "People like you are a real inspiration to me." Then the title of the book, the cartoon for the title of the book is a bunch of horsemen, a posse in the desert, have come upon an abandoned wheelchair, a broken down and abandoned wheelchair that they've been tracking. And one of the horsemen is saying to the other, "Don't worry, he won't get far on foot."
These cartoons are really very funny. I wonder if people are ever afraid to laugh at some of them, especially the ones about amputees and people in wheelchairs and stuff like that, because they might be afraid that the laughter would be perceived as laughing at people with disabilities.
Yes, I think people have that ambivalent feeling. I get stopped by people all the time that say that they would like to laugh, or they do laugh, and then they feel guilty, and then they go back to laughing, and then they feel guilty, you know. So it creates this kind of a strain in people.
What do you tell them?
I just tell them I don't know what to say about it. I guess it's funny, it's funny. And personally, I wouldn't have drawn them if I didn't think they were funny, you know.
Does it make a difference to people who are seeing your cartoons if they know that you are paraplegic yourself?
Yes, it seems to make a difference. People are very condemning of me until they find out or read that I'm paralyzed. And then they suddenly agree that I have a license to kill or something.
What have your most controversial cartoons been?
In the book, I have my first angry letter, which is I have framed at the house with many to follow, but it's a picture of just a guy at a bar with no hands, and he has hooks for hands on both hands, and the bartender's turning him down, saying, sorry, Mike, you just can't hold your liquor. And but when I drew that, many people with the disability of having, you know, amputated hands or something have come up to me on the street in different cities and said how much they've enjoyed my work, and in particular the hook jokes.
What did people object to about that cartoon? What more specifically, what does that letter say that you've got framed on your wall?
Well, the letter was kind of a classic, actually. It wrote to a magazine saying, how dare this Callahan cartoonist be so cruel to our, you know, courageous friends, the handicapped. And they never suspect that I'm also handicapped.
Have stupid questions that you're asked about being handicapped led to cartoons?
Sometimes, yes. As a matter of fact, that first cartoon I described with the two cut-off heads talking, because many people come to me and say, you know, people like you are a real inspiration to me, which is a really strange feeling to have when you've only been in their presence for 30 seconds or so.
Right. When you started sending in cartoons to editors, did they know that that you were paralyzed? And I'm thinking especially if you were sending in cartoons about handicapped people.
Well, the magazines that I began working for submitting to early on were those kind of magazines that had these kind of handicapped, sometimes amputee jokes, National Lampoon and Penthouse. And Penthouse began to buy my work, 5 years ago, and they had no knowledge of me or my situation until I sent them a longer piece I wrote called The Lighter Side of Being Paralyzed for Life, which is kind of throughout this, pieces of it are throughout this autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And they then decided that they would pick up the phone and call me and ask me if it was really true that I was, you know, handicapped and what a great story this is, and would I draw some more handicapped cartoons for them.
Can you take the same liberties with other people, or does it come off as sexist or racist?
Well, I guess people are touchy about their special interest groups like that. I mean, I've drawn, I have, for instance, a cartoon which is very popular. It's a picture of a cafe. On the window of the cafe, it says the Anorexia Cafe, and there's a small sign in the door that says, now closed 24 hours a day. And it's extremely popular, but, you know, it gets me in a little trouble sometimes. You know, people do write in. Usually, almost always, people who write the angry letters are not a member of that group that I'm featuring in the cartoon.
But most people probably find it reassuring when you're a member of the minority that's featured in the cartoon. Because that's kind of proof that it's a joke about us, not a joke about them.
Yes. So someday I think I'm going to have a newspaper headline printed saying that Callahan the cartoonist has actually just been faking it all the years. He's not disabled, but he just did it to be able to draw these kind of cartoons.
Or you could say you're really a black woman and then kind of broaden the the subject matter you could cartoon about.
An anorexic.
Oh, but that's right. Did you have the same kind of sense of humor before your accident?
Yes, I did. I had it as a kid. I remember doing a kind of cynical, humor for my parents, kind of stand-up in the days when I could stand up. You know, as a 5 or 6-year-old kid, I would try to entertain the family around the kitchen table.
Was it hard for you to find your sense of humor after your accident?
Well, it took. I think it was always there, but, overwhelming, depressions and stuff and disorientation for the first months and years are quite something to contend with. But my humor did get me through it, and I was drawing cartoons in physical therapy. I didn't so much enjoy what they had to give me in occupational therapy. Like, they wanted me to strengthen my hands and arms by sanding a piece of wood, and I didn't relate to it, so I just picked up a pen with two hands and drew cartoons and started drawing cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write in your book that it's a fact of paralyzed life that people want to come up to you and cure you by delivering you to Jesus.
Yeah, I find that's true. I cite a couple of examples in the book. I mean, someone recently came up and told me, asked me if he could cure me, if I would be willing to be cured by Christ to be able to walk. And I just told him, I said, I just paid $5,000 for this new wheelchair. Do you mind if I get a couple months' worth out of it before? You know, I think they're nice and everything, but, I mean, sometimes I just describe or open the book, my autobiography, to page whatever it is, and I show the picture and I'm respectful of the Christians, but I happen to have a cartoon which I think is respectful toward Christianity. It's a picture of Jesus on the cross, crucified, and he's thinking wearily to himself, TGIF. And that's enough to get rid of any, the most resolved Christian cure on the street.
Does it ever make you angry that people would would approach you and say, "Well, I've got the cure if you follow my way."
Yeah, well, this seems funny, but I mean, just yesterday, my friend Kevin and I were sitting somewhere in front of a restaurant, and a guy was standing by there waiting for a cab, and he looked down and he says, "Well, you know, a guy in your condition, you know, I mean, how do you?" I said, "You mean a red-haired person?" He goes, "No." He starts pointing at the wheelchair. I said, "Oh, you mean a person with blue jeans?" He goes, "No. A guy like you who's he just couldn't get it out." It's like, you know. So I like to tease people a little bit, but I have a chapter in the book called How to Relate to Handicapped People, and it's done all in cartoon style. I just encourage people to read that.
And you say that prostitutes hit on you also because they assume you're going to be sexually needy.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that a lot of guys in wheelchairs have commiserated with me about. It's I have drawn this cartoon. I show a picture of myself flying down the street in a wheelchair, and a prostitute is sitting on the corner seductively, and she has the handicap access symbol sewn onto the front of her jeans.
You know, I'm thinking it's what you do to get people to laugh, and one of the many subjects you get people to laugh about is handicaps. But do you ever feel like saying to someone, "Hey, it's not funny"?
Yeah, well, I never really find too many things I don't think are funny to draw cartoons about. But many people come to me and say, "Hey, that's not funny. You shouldn't draw about that, but draw like that. I mean, that's something you shouldn't touch, you know."
Uh-huh. Well, John, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
John Callahan's autobiography, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, is published by William Morrow. He spoke to us from KBOO in Portland, Oregon. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, one of the leaders of the student movement in China has escaped from the People's Republic, and when he passed through Hong Kong, he talked to reporters. We'll have a story on that. Japan's government once again is scandalized. This time it's not influence peddling, it's sex for pay, and we'll have a story. We're going to take a long look at the radical environmental movement Earth First tonight. We're going to pay some attention to the new recommendation that the American Cancer Society and others has made that women between the ages of 40 and 50 should have annual mammograms. And we have an interview with an audio artist, Max Newhouse.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Americans who want to appear cultured and upper class often resort to using British expressions and phrases of speech, and according to our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, they almost always get it wrong.
I got an invitation to a show at one of San Francisco's Tonier art galleries. A very classy piece of work, at least up to the announcement at the bottom, the gallery shall remain open until 8 p.m. on Thursday evenings. That probably wasn't what they meant, not unless the extended hours were required by law. What they meant to say was the gallery will remain open, but they tried to gild the frame and wound up with that most embarrassing of slips, the bungled Anglicism. The distinction between shall and will is the flower of what H.W. Fowler used to call the English of the English, but the rules are as tangled and thorny as an English bramble. For one thing, the meaning of shall and will changes according to the subject. You shall expresses an obligation or makes a promise. You will makes a simple prediction. If an Englishman tells you, "You shall have your money," he means that he's going to pay you. But if he says, "You will have your money," you can whistle for it. But in the first person, the meanings are reversed. Here it's "I shall" that makes the prediction, and "I will" that expresses the promise or determination. The difference is summed up in the old story about a Frenchman foundering in the surf off Brighton who yells, "Help, I will drown, and no one shall save me," so nobody does. But it isn't only foreigners who have trouble with shall and will. The Scots and Irish don't bother with the distinction, a point that the English have historically taken as a clear indication of the mental deficiencies of the Celtic races. And in America, the English use of shall has never really taken root outside New England. As James Thurber wrote, men who use shall west of the Appalachians are the kind who twirl canes and eat ladyfingers. Granted, it's a charming distinction, but Americans are bound to screw it up. Even General Douglas MacArthur got it wrong when he announced his intention to recapture the Philippines by saying, "I shall return," where it was, "I will return," that really expresses the determination he had in mind. It's not the kind of thing you can pick up in the course of a junior year abroad. As the 19th century Bostonian writer Richard Grant White put it, the distinction is too subtle for persons who have not had the advantage of early intercourse with educated English people, English in blood and breeding. But then, why would any self-respecting American want to touch this business with a barge pole? When I hear an American reaching for a shall, it puts me in mind of the flap that was raised a couple of years ago when a White House protocol officer was photographed curtsying to Queen Elizabeth. As one critic commented, "We fought a war about that." Maybe Thomas Jefferson and Noah Webster were right when they suggested that we should have thrown the King's English over the side along with a king and called our language American or federal or some such thing. Then nobody would be tempted to assume that the English own the language just because it's named after them. And we might have been spared this game of linguistic upstairs-downstairs that's gone on 200 years too long. I like to believe that hell has its own American quarter, with a special circle set aside for Anglophiles, though of course they call it a roundabout. At its center is a cozy pub where one can park one's motor car, loosen one's braces, and chat over the controversies of the day, with one's legs crossed like Alistair Cook and one's Filofax in one's lap. But for everything that comes out of your mouth, you pay the price in what goes into it. For the place serves nothing but English food. You spend eternity drinking warm lager and eating fish and chips wrapped in grease-sodden newspapers, English newspapers still wet from the presses, so that you can read about Di and Fergie on every piece of cod.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Ian Fraser is best known for his New Yorker humor pieces, but on the next Fresh Air, Fraser talks about his exploration of the Great Plains. It's the subject of his new book. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker plays some current records that get little or no airplay in this country, but are big hits overseas. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's controversial new movie, Do the Right Thing. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Karen Impala, and Steve Plever. Research assistants from Liz Trubert and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.